This is A Different Brilliant, an Aspect podcast focusing on the strengths, interests, and aspirations of the autistic community. Open, authentic, and engaging conversations about autism. Made for autistic people, parents, and carers of children on the autism spectrum. Welcome to A Different Brilliant.
And welcome to A Different Brilliant. I'm your host, Madeline Jane Lobsey, and I am joined today by Bella Smythe. Bella is a social worker and also a behaviour support practitioner and a supervisor in that, who has supported people, autistic people, for 9 years. Bella started her career as a support worker and then completed her Masters of Social Work. Very cool, Bella. Bella has a passion for supporting individuals, service providers, and families, particularly with age-appropriate strategies and providing opportunities for choice and active engagement, particularly in supported accommodation and day program settings. Bella is committed to sharing her experience and knowledge of behavior, positive behavior support strategies to support inclusivity. So welcome, Bella.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's always weird hearing about yourself, isn't it? It's a bit of a funny thing. Anyway, there we go. So today we're going to talk about a term that is used a lot, and I'd almost say it's a buzzword in a way. Like, it's definitely something that is expressed regularly, and you see it everywhere, and that's neurodiversity. And we're going to talk about, you know, what it actually means. And then we're going to, you know, I think more interestingly, talk about what it means to work within neurodivergent communities. So how about we start with the basics, Bella, and yep, just try and, you know, create for people, what does this word neurodiversity, we might say neurodivergent too, but let's start with neurodiversity. What does it mean?
Yeah, so neurodiversity is the idea that variations in neurological functioning or how the brain works are natural and valuable parts of human diversity. So rather than reviewing differences as deficits, neurodiversity recognizes them as a rich spectrum of human experience, each contributing unique strengths and perspectives as well. And it challenges, the idea of neurodiversity does challenge the traditional view that neurological differences are problems that need to be fixed or, you know, as I said, kind of deficits or things like that. And instead, it promotes the understanding that different ways of thinking, different ways of learning, different ways of being and interacting with the world can enrich our society too.
Oh my goodness, so well said. That was very well said. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. And I guess I've always heard, for a really basic way for people to look at it, is if you need something to compare it to, it's no different than talking about cultural diversity or biodiversity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. There's no normal or right style of human mind, as there is no right or normal, you know, ethnicity, gender, culture, all of those kinds of things as well. So it really looks at that there is no set way of the mind being or the set way that someone should be, but really valuing the natural diversity that, you know, across everybody and how everyone thinks and learns and interacts.
Yeah. And so we really do mean everybody, but specifically, you know, I'm autistic ADHD, and I know you are as well. And so for us, we're going to be looking at this particularly from a neurodivergent perspective, because we are neurodivergent. And yes, also, you know, I know that that's your area of expertise and the group of people that you're working with. So the word itself really expresses everybody, but today we're focusing on neurodivergent people.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, and as you know, neurodiverse is very much more a lens or an umbrella term, you know, and that in, and, you know, underneath that neurodivergence kind of sits under that in terms of differences in brain and those kinds of things too.
Yeah. So I think that's probably a good place for us to start to try and say, you know, what people talk about it like an umbrella, like what fits, or you could, I like the word lens actually that you used, but, you know, people talk about it like an umbrella and just at least begin to express what are some of the things that fit in underneath the umbrella of being neurodivergent. And we're not going to say them all.
Yes, absolutely. And even Even like as I said, a note on language. So it's important to remember that different people will identify differently, and not all those who have these diagnoses will identify with the terms neurodiverse or neurodivergent. So it's always about talking to the person, and, you know, as best practice and their preferences around that. And, you know, the terms that do sit under the neurodivergent.
I just want to pause you for a second, because I think what you said was so important, that it is actually really important. You know, we're going to talk about something. This is, and I did use the word buzzword, but that doesn't mean that everybody's going to identify with this as a word. So, you know, that thing you said about it being important for people to be able to say, I think that's super critical. This is not a trend. This is a way of expressing something and people have a choice about it.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So looking at, I guess, some of the like neurodiversity terms and some of the kind of what might sit under it, and what we're going to talk about is not everything that sits under it. You know, it could go on for a really long time.
Someone told me there's hundreds, apparently, but anyway.
Yes. There's still, you know, research is still very new with this. So they're still really figuring out, you know, what hits under that term, and people might have other diagnoses that they feel do fit under that. And absolutely, you know, they can. So it is very, there are some, you know, I guess some different diagnoses that do sit under it, but there's also much, much broader than that, as we know, with everyone
including
being so different,
identifying as well. Like, you might not have an actual diagnosis and still identify neurodivergent or one of the things that we're about to talk about.
Yes. Yeah. So some of the terms, some of the, I guess, diagnoses that might fall under that, probably the most common in terms of well-known would be autism and ADHD, are kind of the, you know, the starting point for...
A lot of people, most of the community would probably, you know, like a large portion of our community would start with those terms. Yeah.
Yes. But there's a lot of other terms that can sit under it. Down syndrome, dyscalculia.
I can't say it either.
I really struggle saying that word. Yeah. Dysgraphia, where there might be differences in writing or again, some challenges around writing and words. Dyslexia, dyspraxia, which can be around coordination. Two, intellectual disabilities can sit under it, as well as mental health conditions, which then broadens that up even more. Prader-Willi syndrome, sensory processing conditions as well, social anxiety, and other anxieties that fall under the kind of mental health too. Tourette's, and Williams syndrome are just some of the sort of the main ones. But as we said, you know, research and our understanding of what sits under that kind of neurodivergent terminology still evolving.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is such a rich conversation, and I think we were saying before we even started the podcast that we probably could do an episode on every single one of the things you just rolled off then. But at the same time, like as you were rolling off the list, I was like, okay, well, I can already tick five of the things that you said under the list. So I think that's that's probably the thing that I find most powerful about this term neurodivergent, because there are many things that I can say, yes, that is the way my brain works and the way that I process the world, that aren't just autism or ADHD. And I find that very empowering, and I think it's very common for us.
Absolutely. And, you know, and I know we're going to talk about this in a little bit around sort of co-occurring conditions, but I think, you know, there are a lot of people that would identify with multiple of those, you know, I guess diagnoses or you know, experiences would fall under that as well. So I think, you know, for a lot of people, you know, hearing some of those things that, you know, might identify with a number of things under that neurodivergent umbrella, and sometimes it can be tricky to necessarily, you know, separate from that. And that's why I think having that neurodivergent, you know, terminology can really help people, rather than, you know, having to list off, oh, these are all the diagnoses.
I do, and I feel it's like, I don't know, for me it's more holistic. Like when I just say I'm autistic, which I am, it doesn't create the whole of my experience of life, whereas I find neurodivergent does for me.
And for me, I had a lot of different diagnoses, you know, over the years in terms of people, you know, I was only diagnosed very late in life with autism and ADHD. And before that, a lot of different, you know, mental health and things like that. And that's where I find that kind of neurodivergent, the best way of expressing my experience, because, you know, even with those diagnoses, I don't know if I fully fit into all of those categories or exactly fit into all the diagnostic criteria for those things. So neurodivergent and just, you know, having that understanding that I see the world a little bit differently, I think a little bit differently, is really empowering in a sense.
Yeah. And I'm quite visual, right? So I always imagine that there's not a lot of research at the moment about it. Like, we know that it's very modern research. And I always think about, you know, there's somewhere on the planet that, you know, some person that's like obsessed with dyspraxia, like that's their whole thing and they're researching about it, right? And then there's someone else that's just obsessed with dyslexia and they're researching about it. And the exciting part for me will be when we start having that kind of research and those people talking to one another and looking for connections or things that don't connect, or looking for the cumulative impact of those things together. Like, I think that's probably the next field of research and what we're looking at.
I think so. And there's still, you know, statistic wise, there's still neurodivergent, you know, there aren't, you know, people are still trying to understand the ratio statistics or what that kind of looks like. You know, I know for autism, previously it was, you know, a couple of, we only, you know, 4 years ago it was 1 in 70. Now they're saying it's 1 in 40. Like, it's really evolving as people are understanding, I think, and as well thinking a little bit outside the box of that DSM-5 criteria for autism or for ADHD.
Which is the basic way of diagnosing the DSM-5, for anyone who doesn't know, is like a basic diagnostic tool. Yeah. Yeah. Looking broadly. And I also, the current statistic is 1 in 20 for neurodivergent. So, you know, and I always say that's a super conservative figure given the little research and the access to diagnosis and all the rest of it. But yeah, at the moment, what is said is 1 in 20. So we're talking about a lot of people. And I think probably what's interesting now is to start to talk about co-occurring conditions. You're saying, I say co-occurring experiences because that is actually how I experience the world. But same thing. And, you know, I think, again, it's only a modern thing that people even realize you could be autistic and ADHD plus whatever else.
Yes. Yeah. So prior to the last DSM-5 release, I think it was 2013, clinicians were unable to make an ADHD diagnosis in the context of autism. So they thought it was kind of, you know, secondary. So again, they're really, you know, we're talking, you know, not all that long ago that they couldn't actually, they weren't being diagnosed either together. And so it's kind of quite a new thing in terms of what that looks like and understanding, you know, the similarities, the differences, how they sort of can co-occur together, sitting under that kind of neurodivergent umbrella. And that's where likely a lot of people have, you know, either been misdiagnosed or have gone undiagnosed. And that's where a lot of adults, you know, are now starting to kind of come forward and say, oh, you know, maybe, you know, can I look at getting a diagnosis? You know, can I, these sorts of things, because yeah, historically it's been very kind of undiagnosed, and those kind of and the understanding of the co-occurring conditions has, you know, is still also very new.
Yeah. And I think the most common story, certainly I hear, and I talk to, I don't know, thousands of neurodivergent people, the most common story I hear is possibly, if they're lucky, someone was diagnosed young, you know, either autistic or ADHD. And then it can be 10, 20, 30 years before they get the next diagnosis for exactly that reason.
Yes.
So, yeah, that is definitely common. And I think it's also important to say we're not just saying autistic ADHD, we're talking about all the things that fit under the neurodivergent umbrella.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And there's a lot of studies, and I will, a little warning that I'm going to talk about mental health for a couple of minutes. But, you know, I think there's a lot of studies and things coming out around the co-occurring, you know, depression, anxiety, bipolar, there's quite a high statistic of that kind of co-occurring with autism, ADHD, post-traumatic stress disorder, OCD, eating disorders, all of these things that there are quite common things, and particularly depression and anxiety are very common as well at a significantly higher rate than kind of the typical population. And I think this is due to a lot of the long-term effects of needs not being met, you know, social environments not set up for neurodivergent people, social exclusions and differences in kind of social interactions and learning that may not be well supported by the kind of more neurotypical approaches. So that feeling of kind of exclusion, those feelings of you know, difference and those feelings of not necessarily being set up in a world that's very bright, in a world that's very loud, in a world, you know, where there's a lot of unspoken social cues.
Yeah, constant correction. Don't do that. Do it this way. Why are you doing that?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. You know, historically, you know, things like stimming, you know, being seen as or, you know, very much with the eye contact, you know, as well, always a lot of those kind of social norms. And I think, you know, because of the way that, yeah, society is structured in that sense, it doesn't set, it sets up for more, you know, mental health conditions to come out through that, which makes it very, understandable.
Yeah. And it is important. I know you sort of gave a bit of a warning about talking about mental health. Look, the fact is, if people are listening to this, whether they are neurodivergent themselves or parenting or caring or a teacher or whatever, you know, the chances are extremely high that mm-hmm. either themselves or the people around them are dealing with mental health conditions, you know, at the same time. And I think it's important for us to say, that's like not the end of the world or not something to be really frightened about or concerned about, because when a human being gets supported and gets what they need, you can have anything going on and it can all work out. So, you know, I think that's also important to say to people that are listening. So I think that's why what you do is, well, flat out critical, but also exciting, about spending your days working with neurodivergent people, because what we know is with the right environments and the right support, you know, life's great. So why don't we just try and get it a bit more real now and start to talk about what your work is like, what's it like working in your community, just sort of share with us what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think being neurodivergent myself, I think has really helped my, I guess, my approach and my practice. And I'm very much being, I think, social work background, I'm very big at looking at kind of systems and environments around a person rather than necessarily looking at, okay, this is the diagnosis, this is what we're doing for this, but rather looking, you know, I do a lot of work with families where, you know, it's, you know, I want to fit in with what they do. I want to, you know, get to know them, get to know their systems, how they work. And really, rather than coming in with an expert saying, oh, we need to do visuals or we need to do this way, or, you know, having a really different approach and having them say, well, what, how does your family work? What works for you? What does a day look like? What does a day look like for your child? And, you know, bringing those strengths or adult, you know, absolutely as well. I'd say families because we're for the children, but I, you know, again, with adults too. And, you know, seeking, I think a lot of it is understanding. And that's the feedback that I've had from, you know, families or adults that I've worked with, is more so having an understanding about what might, you know, contribute to anxiety, or even just, you know, acknowledging and understanding that, you know, around neurodiversity and you're neurodivergent, to help support in, you know, to get their perspective rather than bringing in my own perspective first.
Yeah, it's so good, the thing you just said, because I think, you know, when you do get a diagnosis particularly, oh, there's just a world that comes with it. You know, what does that mean? And I mean, there's just a lot. And then the focus can very much become on the diagnosis itself, or the person that's got the diagnosis, right? But when mm-hmm. you say systems, what you mean is just life, like, you know, mm-hmm. how's the household environment? What are the relationships there? How are you feeding yourselves? Who does the cooking? Who, you know, like just life. When you say systems, and when that's working, when the, you know, self-care and the cleaning and the eating and the traveling and the heading to school or work or whatever, is when you're working on those environments, that's the kind of work you're doing that has a human being flourish, not how do we fix this person with a diagnosis.
Yes. And I think it comes with open, you know, it's really open-mindedness and acceptance and, you know, meeting, you know, that person at where they're at, or, you know, are they, you know, what are they wanting, rather than saying, I think this would be best. You know, what is that person's goals? What are those person's interests and strengths? What environments are around that person? And how can we support more neuroaffirming environments? And that's where I think I really appreciate that, you know, in terms of the neurodiversity movement, to move away from looking at things like stimming as behavior, or, you know, and rather looking at it as a really helpful tool for people. And I think, you know, having that openness and having those conversations and supporting people to understand and feel okay about some of those things. And it's okay if you don't want to make eye contact, you know, that's not, we don't, you know, and I think, you know, moving forward, I think that has been some of the best outcomes of that movement, is to support people to feel more accepted to be themselves. I think obviously as a society, we still have a really long way to go to really, you know, support that, and things like this podcast support people's understandings and acceptance. And I think that's the big key around supporting neurodivergent individuals.
Yeah. The thing, when we did your introduction, the thing that I found great was age appropriate, that those two words, age appropriate, because I think a lot of the time the focus, well, up until sort of recent history, the focus has been so heavily on children and teens, and we've only, you know, it hasn't been that long, although Aspect has quite the history, but it hasn't been that long that we've really gone, okay, well, what do adults need? And I think that's exciting about the work you're doing there. So why don't you talk about some of the sites and things you're doing with Aspect with adults?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it is research and diagnostic is based on, children's presentation. So there's still not a lot around. And I guess through some of the work that I work in some community access programs that we have in Victoria for 18 and above. So I think the oldest participant we have is 69, 70, and as young as sort of 16, where we support and promote, you know, community access programs, going to the gym, going, you know, out to cafes, going to restaurants, you know, to support and build skills and goals that are important to that person. I have historically worked majority with adults. That's just been my passion, and particularly adults who also have intellectual disabilities as well. So I've been, you know, and looking at, you know, even sensory tools, things like that can often be very much based more on
little rainbow unicorns, which, you know, I mean, personally, I'm all in on a little rainbow unicorn, but not everyone is.
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, a lot of, you know, supports and strategies, again, have been very focused more on children. And that's where I've been very passionate about, how do we bring age appropriate supports? How do we bring choice and control for adults who, you know, have intellectual disabilities additionally, to really, you know, provide that inclusivity in our communities, and sort of engage with, you know, other community systems and other providers, and really kind of, you know, broaden and expand, you know, what people's understanding is around autism and around adults who have a diagnosis of autism or who are neurodivergent, and what that looks like. So we've been doing a lot of work with like community centers, you know, again, like gyms and places like that, to try and set up more autism and neurodivergent friendly environments. Can we reduce the bright lights? Can we reduce some of the sounds? Can we go at quieter times? You know, what else can we do to kind of support that as well?
If I went to one of the sites in, they're in Victoria, I know. If I went there, what would I see there? Like, what does it look like? What happens in a day?
Yeah, so they get dropped off in the morning, and then we run programs of support. So we run a couple. There'll be like a program on site for those that may want to stay more in the centre. There'll be a program off site.
Like
so
what? They get to program choose. Like what?
Program like art therapy. Competitive sports. Shopping is one for particularly people
Brilliant,
who might have
perfect.
Goals around going shopping at
or
the
just
community.
Shopping at in general, you know? A joy of shopping.
Yes, go ahead. Yeah, going to Bunnings to get stuff because I know some of our sites have like chicken coops, you know, going to Bunnings to get all the stuff to look after the chickens and, you know, maintenance where they fix things around the sites and, you know, engage in a lot of these different life skills as well as that community access. I think the most popular program I'd say is cafe, very understandably so because everyone everyone queues up for cafe. Who doesn't love a caramel slice and a coffee?
Exactly.
And having, you know, some supported, facilitated, you know, social interactions and support around that as well, which can be, really nice. And we've got a lot of connections with the local cafes and, you know, we have visual menus of what they might have. So we can sit with the participants before and kind of go through some photos of what they might like to order. When they get there and you know, print off a map to say this is the way that we're going to be walking there, this is what we might see along the way, you know, thinking about some of those approaches to sort of make that engagement with the community as neuroaffirming as possible.
Yeah, I think that's what's so cool. Look, we need a language that is clinical to be able to talk about this kind of stuff. So it is important to say things like systems and processes and programs and, you know, all of those words that we use. But what you're talking about really is someone being able to be out in life as themselves, as a legend, as empowered human being. And if they want a blueberry muffin and not a caramel slice, able to say it in the moment when it's crowded and loud and everyone's going, what can I get you? Like, we're just talking about life.
Yes. And, you know, I think making kind of really, and they can be, you know, small changes, you know, showing someone a photo of where they're going to park, you know, showing, you know, having sensory friendly waiting areas in environments. And I do work with, I do some training for kind of external organizations around how to sort of make, you know, more neuroaffirming, you know, processes of people having to access spaces or centres or whatever it might be to support some of that inclusion and support some of that understanding and learning for everybody in the community as much as possible.
And I think I just keep thinking we're saying neuroaffirming a lot, and just to clarify what we mean by that is, you know, people can look at it like a problem or a deficit or someone that needs help. And what we're talking about is, no, if you relate to them as, you know, entirely capable and that we put things in place that are going to leave them fully able to be themselves and empowered, then that's what we mean when we say neuroaffirming. So, Bella, what are some of the myths? I laugh because I go, I can't believe these myths still exist. But what are some of the myths about social life or social interactions?
I think that there's two sides to this one, I think. So there is very much a myth of that, or, you know, neurodivergent people might have challenges in social settings, you know, but as well there's something, you know, around that double empathy problem where autistic people are actually very good at interacting with other autistic people because there is that understanding. There's a gap, you know, between potentially neurotypical people and neurodivergent people around those sort of social interactions that it just looks a little bit different. Neither are right, neither are wrong. It doesn't mean that people who are neurodivergent aren't social. That is a very large myth, as well as, you know, I've, you know, definitely heard, oh, you know, she can't be autistic, she's so social. And I think that also leads into another myth, particularly around presentation in females or assigned female at birth, around that, you know, statistically it sits much lower in terms of the diagnostic kind of, because they don't under, because we're still studying. They're still understanding what, you know, neurodivergent kind of how that presents in females. Again, there can be, you know, masking or a lot more masking, a lot more kind of hiding, you know, features about themselves as well. So I think that it is, you know, still evolving. And the studies, you know, the ratios are very high that, you know, in terms of being diagnosed more in males than females. And I know, you know, so for that, I think is another myth too, is around, you know, the understanding of it in females, oh, like maybe that it's less, but it's actually not. It's just that our understanding of it and how it presents looks very different.
Yeah.
And we're still getting to know.
We really are. All right. Well, I think you and I could say a lot more about myths, but we're going to leave it there. Is there, you know, I was thinking, how would I wrap this up? And I guess my from me as an autistic ADHD neurodivergent person, what I would say is that the term neurodivergent or neurodiversity is empowering. It's not a trend. And it really gives me access to talking about the whole of who I am. Is there anything that you would want to say or anything to wrap this up?
No, I think I'm really excited about, you know, these terminologies and what I'm seeing in terms of our kind of society and cultures and the understanding. And I think the more that we can support educating, you know, everybody, I think that is, you know, the best step forward for inclusivity, is just understanding. That's all we want, you know, and that is the best way to move forward, I think, which is happening. Yeah.
Well said, Bella. Well, thank you for everything that you do in your work and in your life and spending time with us today, and we appreciate you.
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to A Different Brilliant, an Aspect podcast focusing on the strengths, interests, and aspirations of the autistic community. If you would like to learn more, visit our website, aspect.org.au, to listen to past episodes or send us a message. Make sure to like or subscribe to A Different Brilliant on your podcast app.